Hebrews chapter 7, verse 6 to chapter 8, verse 3. The 25th talk in a series on the book of Hebrews was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 14, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are in the book of Hebrews, and we're going to continue on. We've made it up to our about to finish chapter 7 and push our way into chapter 8 this week. But I want to start by briefly reviewing to put all this in the context in which we need to understand it. The fundamental issue in the very second portion of the book of Hebrews, he starts off with a portion of exhortations. And then when he gets to the second portion of the book, which starts about chapter 5, he narrows down to the fundamental issue. And that is, did Jesus' death disqualify him from being the Messiah? Now, to us, that sounds like a ridiculous question and a silly question, but to the Jews to whom he's writing this, that was a stumbling block. That was a fundamental problem, because getting yourself killed didn't seem very much like the Messiah sent from God. So Paul wants to deal with that issue of the relationship between Jesus' death, his crucifixion, and his messiahship. And he's going to argue that it didn't disqualify him, it actually qualified him, but he needs to make that case, and he begins that in chapter 5. In the very first section, he introduces the primary thesis of his answer to that, of his rebuttal, and that is, as the Messiah, he was assigned the task of functioning as the ultimate high priest for mankind. And that's going to be the answer to his question. Does his death disqualify him? No, because he was the ultimate high priest. That was the role that was given him to play. And his own death was his own offering as the high priest. Well, he introduces and asserts that in the very first section, in the opening of chapter 5. Then he has a relatively long parenthetical section where he explores the concern he has about why it is that they're having trouble with Jesus, and he warns them and exhorts them they need to stay the course and not give up on Jesus. Then, when he's finished with that parenthetical section, at the beginning of chapter 7, he comes to the third section where he finally narrows down and focuses to make his argument for why Jesus' death makes sense and is no reason to reject the claim that he is the Messiah. In the first part of his argument, and the argument that he builds is a subtle, painstaking, step-by-step-by-step argument. He takes it very slowly. He doesn't make very many leaps. So he builds the case slowly. He starts by introducing the concept of Melchizedek out of Psalm 110. The entire argument is going to be based on Psalm 110 and an assertion, a promise that gets made in Psalm 110. He begins in the first part of chapter 7, section 3.1 in my translation, and explores what it is that David meant when he employed Melchizedek as a poetic symbol in Psalm 110. And he decides, you can digest it down to God was promising the role of priest to one who was in fact and indeed the Messiah. So the promise being made was of a Messiah priest. Secondly, God was promising the role of priest to a Messiah priest who stood entirely outside the priesthood that gets established under the Mosaic Covenant. He's not a Levitical priest. He's an entirely different cat. He wouldn't even be qualified under the Mosaic Covenant to be a priest. He stands apart from that whole institution. And then thirdly, the priesthood that's assigned to the Messiah was a permanent and ultimate priesthood, not temporary and provisional as the Levitical priesthood was. And that's primarily what he explores in that section. Then we come to the second subsection, which we'll be finishing up today. And here he's spelling out the implications of the promise made in Psalm 110. And he focuses on the fact that it means that the promised Messiah priest will serve under the terms of a new and a different and a better covenant than the Mosaic covenant. And that's primarily what he's been focused on throughout this section. He makes four key points in this section, in what I call part 13. In paragraph 34, he says that Psalm 110 implies that propitiation does not occur under the Levitical priesthood and the Mosaic covenant. And I commented last week, note how different this is from various traditional ways of understanding our faith. I grew up thinking, many of you probably grew up thinking, that back in the old days under the Mosaic covenant, how did you get the wrath of God propitiated? You took animals to the temple and offered the animals to God in the temple, and the wrath of God was propitiated because of your offering that you offered. Unfortunately, it didn't last real long, so you had to come back and do it again and again and again. It worked, it just didn't work well, and it didn't work permanently. That's not what Paul's arguing. What Paul's arguing is it didn't work at all. There was nothing about the animal offerings in the Mosaic covenant that were ever intended by God to function as the basis for God's wrath being propitiated. It was never true, and it never will be true. It wasn't true back then, and it's not true now. But so he makes that point in paragraph 34. In paragraph 35, the new priest promised by Psalm 110 must, as a matter of course, require a new priesthood and a new covenant. So there's going to be a new priesthood and a new covenant because the Messiah priest that's going to come couldn't possibly serve, couldn't possibly function according to the terms of the Mosaic covenant as the priests under the Mosaic covenant did. So there's going to have to be a new covenant that he's going to serve. And then thirdly, in paragraph 36, he promises that this new priesthood and this new covenant that results leads to a more certain hope of propitiation, more certain for a variety of reasons, but the one he focuses on in paragraph 36 is that the priest is immortal. The priest promised in Psalm 110 is going to be a priest to the end of time. He will be immortal. He will not die. He will be permanent. Again, note how different this is from some traditional ways of understanding this. It is not a more certain hope of propitiation because Jesus' death was infinitely better and his blood more infinitely capable of cleansing us than was the blood of animals. Rather, it is a certain hope of propitiation because the Messiah priest, who we know to be Jesus, will always be alive and available to the end of time to intercede for us. That's what he highlights in this paragraph. He's always going to be around and available. Well, I would argue that this is one of the compelling things in Hebrews that points in the direction of what I have called the effective advocacy view of the atonement as opposed to the full satisfaction view of the atonement. It's not that Jesus' death paid for the sins of mankind. It's that the high priest, the true and ultimate high priest appointed to be our advocate, is one who's going to be able to effectively appeal to God for mercy on my behalf, and I will receive it. And it's significant then that he's always going to be there to be that advocate. Unlike a Levitical priest who might intercede, but if he dies, he's gone. He can't intercede any longer. Now we have one more paragraph in this section, and in the paragraph coming up, the point he's going to make is that the priest promised in Psalm 110 is not one who's subject to the same failings and weaknesses as the Levitical priest. Rather, he's the undefiled high priest that we need in order to offer a better hope of propitiation. And we'll look at this in some detail, but in effect what he's saying is, if you were to send an advocate in before the judge to advocate for you and appeal to God for mercy, would you send another one of you in? Is one more sinner going to be in any better position to ask God for mercy than you yourself would be? Not really. Why would God listen to him? Our problem is we have no reason to think that God would listen to us to begin with. Take another version of me and send him in. Why would God listen to him? But what if you have an advocate who is sinless, who is pure, who is righteous, who is completely and totally pleasing to the judge, to the Father? If he goes in and advocates for me, I have a much better hope, as he puts it, of me attaining the mercy that I want from the judge. Okay, so we need to look at this last paragraph here. Any questions on that review before we get into the particulars?
When you said that Jesus is available to the end of time to intercede, after the next age begins, we won't need anyone to intercede
right.
for us.
That's why I'm going to argue that I think by the end of time, he means the end of this created reality that we're now in.
This age.
Once he creates a new heavens and a new earth, and all things are made new, I don't think there will be any role for a high priest to play at that point.
That's what I was hoping would be true.
Yeah. So I think that's, he says to the end, or to the age, I think often the phrase he uses. But the way I would interpret what he's saying, that is, there is a last and final age coming, and through this age and up to the beginning of the next age, that's the time where he will be available to intercede and be our advocate and function as our high priest. Okay, so we're at paragraph 37, so that's chapter 7, verse 26. I'm reading from my translation here. Now such a high priest, when indeed he is exalted above the heavens, is exactly what we need, devoted to God, void of evil, undefiled, separated from sinners. He would have no need day after day, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for those of the people. In fact, he would do this once, offering himself. Now the covenant appoints men as high priests who are deficient, but the word of the oath which came after the covenant appoints the Son, who has been made teleos, unto the end of the age. Okay, let's take that apart phrase by phrase. He says, now such a high priest. What does he mean by such a high priest? Is that looking forward or is that looking backward? Is he saying, now such a high priest is the one I've just been talking about? Or is he saying, now such a high priest is the one I'm about to describe to you? I think it's the latter. I think he's saying, and that's why I put a colon there, now such a high priest as this is who we need. And then what is that high priest? He's devoted to God, void of evil, undefiled, and separated from sinners. I've already commented on the import of this. This is the kind of high priest that we actually need. We don't need another weak, deficient, morally broken human being to be my advocate. We need exactly the opposite of that. We need somebody who can be pleasing to God, who can be a delight to God, who can enter into the presence of God and say, I want Jack in my kingdom. You too. And so, such a high priest is exactly what we need, devoted to God, void of evil, undefiled, separated from sinners. I think that's just four different phrases that he's using to describe his utter and complete moral perfection and sinlessness. Now, most English translations have a list of five things. Notice I've made it four things, and I've treated the fifth thing differently. I don't think it's devoted to God, void of evil, undefiled, separated from sinners, exalted above the heavens. I think because as the paragraph goes on, he doesn't do anything with that. As the paragraph goes on, he's contrasting this priest with the Levitical priests who have to offer up sacrifices first for their own sins and then for the people. The covenant appoints men, he says, as high priests who are deficient, he says later, but the word of the oath, one who has been made teleos. And then the paragraph's over. All he talks about in the whole rest of the paragraph is the moral perfection and sinlessness of this high priest that we need. That's what we need. So I think the things that he mentions, devoted to God, void of evil, undefiled, separated from sinners, are all a way of getting different facets of moral perfection and righteousness and moral purity. The exalted above the heavens is, it's looking forward to what he's going to say here in the next section. Where do we need this high priest to operate on our behalf? In the true tabernacle, in the heavenly tabernacle, not in the earthly tabernacle. So where do we need this morally perfect, sinless high priest to serve on our behalf? In the true presence of God. I'll talk more about the heavenly tabernacle and all that in a second, but that's why I translate it, when indeed he is exalted above the heavens. Even if he were sinless and morally perfect, if he were still on earth with us, going into the tabernacle that Moses built, that still wouldn't do us any good. What he needs is to be introduced into the very presence of God in the ultimate and true tabernacle that counts. So he will be, he is, he's going to argue, but when he gets there, it's critical that he be this morally perfect high priest who really is qualified to advocate for us. So he goes on, he would have no need day after day, like those high priests are the Levitical high priests who serve under the Mosaic covenant, he would have no need day after day like them to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins, and then for those of the people. As the ritual of the offerings go, the high priest needed to offer up offerings for his own sins to receive cleansing and mercy from God for his own sins before he could turn around and offer up offerings for the people. We need a high priest who doesn't need to do that, is what he's saying. We need a high priest who doesn't have any sins that he needs to offer up a propitiatory offering for. In fact, he would do this once, offering himself. Now, what is he talking about? I think it would be possible to make too much of this once. He would offer an offering once. The only point that Paul is making, I think, is that he's making one offering, not two offerings. The Levitical high priest had to offer two, one on his own behalf and one on behalf of the people. We need a high priest who only needs to offer one offering. That's the once that he's talking about, in contrast to the earthly high priest. And I'm not sure what to do with this offering himself. It's easy to know why he would say offering himself when we think of Jesus, but he's not really thinking of Jesus yet in his argument. He's thinking here of who is this priest, this high priest that we need. And it's not clear to me why it should be apparent that he would offer himself. So I'm a little puzzled by that. I don't get that yet. If you have any ideas, I'm open to that. Now the covenant, and by the covenant he means the Mosaic covenant, the Mosaic law. Now the covenant appoints men as high priests who are deficient. And the deficiency that he's talking about here is moral deficiency. They're sinners. They're morally depraved, broken rebels like the rest of us. But that's who the Mosaic covenant appointed to serve and function in the role of priests. But the oath, he says, now what does he mean by the oath? That's a direct reference to Psalm 110. Remember, Psalm 110 says, I have sworn, I will not change my mind. You, speaking to the Messiah, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. So by the oath, he means that portion of Psalm 110 where God is swearing, I swear and I will not change my mind. You are a priest forever. So the oath, which came after the covenant, Psalm 110 is quite a bit later than when the Mosaic covenant came to be, which came after the covenant, appoints the Son, that is, the Messiah. That oath appoints the Son who has been made teleos to the end of the age. And I think the idea is he's not teleos to the end of the age. He appoints him to the end of the age. And then parenthetically, he says, he appoints the Son who has been made teleos. What does he mean by teleos here? By teleos, he means, we've seen this word before, it usually gets translated mature and usually is very unhelpful to us when it gets translated mature, who has been made exactly what God purposed, intended a priest to be. that it's he has arrived at the telos for an individual who is going to function in the capacity as a priest. For him to be teleos means he has attained that intended purpose for a priest. He has achieved that intended purpose. And in this context, probably primarily focused on his sinlessness. How was the Son made teleos? He was put into this earth, created a human being who lived an absolutely morally perfect life in obedience to the Father, living a life that was well-pleasing to the Father, a life of obedience, a life of love, a life of reflecting the very character of God himself. That's what qualifies him to function as the priest that we need. And in that sense, he's teleos. And then how long does the appointment of this Son last? Until the end of the age. And I was, in my answer to Bob, I was suggesting, I think what he means by that, the end of the age is the end of this present physical age right here. The time is going to come. And I would argue that his role is only relevant at certain crucial points in our age. It's crucial when my destiny is going to be determined. And the question is Jesus' advocacy operative at the time when God is determining my destiny? For us, I think that time is when the Lord returns. Because if I die, from my perspective as I read it, I'm in the grave and I stay in the grave and I have no conscious experience. My life, my subjective experience is over for the time being. I don't think there is anything happening for me in my experience until the Lord returns. When the Lord returns, there will be a trumpet blast and a shout, and the Lord himself is going to call me out of the grave. And I go from the slumber of my death, from the lack of consciousness and lack of any awareness of my death, to once again being fully alive, conscious, having a subjective experience as a new creature, as the immortal taking on immortality. Well, what determines whether or not I am going to hear his voice when he calls me out of the grave? On the one hand, it's the choice of God. It's the decision of God. Yes, I want him in my kingdom. Well, why will God want me in my kingdom? What the Bible is suggesting, what Paul is suggesting here is, because Jesus wants me in his kingdom. The power to determine whether I will live or die has been delegated, the authority to do so has been delegated to the Son. And the Son who chooses me determines that God will recreate me and give me existence once more. Death will not conquer me, but I will be given existence again and called out of the grave. Well, that's where Jesus being my advocate, that's the time at which Jesus being my advocate counts. Now, it appears to me that there will be another time when we come to the final resolution of history, when the people who have been alive after the coming of Jesus, who have also come to belief, where their destiny is going to be determined. And at that point, again, whether or not Jesus advocates for them is going to be critical, is going to be a very important role. But after that, the whole fullness of God's people has been set. Everyone who belongs to God is now established, and the present heavens and earth are going to be destroyed, and God is going to create a new heavens and earth, and those people who belong to the people of God are going to go on to live eternally in the eternal kingdom of God. Well, once that destiny has been set, there's no longer the need for a priest, an intercessor, an advocate, and so on. Questions or comments?
Put a comma at the end of your last statement, then the new role for Jesus is?
King. Yeah, king eternally over the kingdom of God.
Can you take a moment with that, or is that too far of a digression?
Can you help me focus with a question?
You were taking some time sort of describing it in sort of terms that were really resonating with me about him being our priest and when it would be effective in our lives in a practical way, calling us out of the grave and so forth. So what about where do we go to hear about Jesus as king?
In the kingdom?
Where do we find out the revelation of God with regard to Jesus being king.
I'm sorry, do you mean where do you go in the Bible? Or
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's everything that it says about the Messiah is speaking of him as king. That's what Messiah means, basically, is the one anointed to be the king over the kingdom of God, over the kingdom of Israel. Now, I thought what you're asking, and I can't help you here much, is can I flesh out the picture of what that's going to look like in eternity? And
yeah,
no, I can't.
I was hoping you were.
Yeah, no, I can't. For the most part, the Bible doesn't. What I've come to see, and maybe I'm wrong, there will be people who would argue with me, but what it appears to me that the Bible is completely focused on history. It says very little about eternity. That's going to be this huge... The only thing it says about it is... It will blow your mind. You have no idea.
So this is a package that we have. We can look forward to.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. The sacrificial system was around for the Jews for a couple thousand years. And did I understand you to say that it had no value, or?
No. It has value. Well, in the next two chapters, he'll go back to that and revisit that a number of times. It's a shadow of what was to come. And so, to the extent that a shadow can be a rough outline and kind of pointer to, indicator toward that which is casting the shadow, to that extent it had value. But it didn't have any effectiveness as actually bringing about propitiation. That's Paul's point.
So when trying to remember the story well, but there was the guy in the temple that, is it Luke, that talks about him being blameless?
Mm-hmm.
And I've always understood that to have something to do with the sacrificial system. He was a godly man. He did make sacrifices for his sins. God accepted those sacrifices, and that's how he was viewed as blameless in the sight of God and men.
Yeah, I think I commented on this last week. I don't know if you were here, but we have to make a distinction between the basis for God's mercy and the condition for God's mercy. The condition changed. It used to be you kept the covenant. For any Jew in the time of Moses, what did God expect from them? If their heart was right, if they had a heart that was oriented toward God, they wanted to honor God, they wanted to respect God, they wanted to serve God, how did they do that? They kept the covenant, including all the sacrifices, the offerings, and so on and so forth. Having met that condition, God is going to grant them mercy. But there's still a question that remains. Okay, they've met the condition such that God is going to grant them mercy. Why is he going to grant them mercy? On what basis does the mercy come? Because he gave them a stinking barbecue, right? Because he fried some animals for them? No, because they have an advocate, Jesus. They don't know anything about this advocate, but it's on the basis of Jesus' advocacy that everyone from Adam on, from the beginning of time, who is going to enter into the kingdom of God as part of the people of God, it's because of Jesus' advocacy that they make it and that they're granted mercy.
Thanks, Jack.
So that's what Paul's talking about. It's the basis for propitiation that he's concerned with here, not the condition for it.
The whole book is addressed to Jews, to Hebrews. And my understanding from Paul in Romans 9 is that one of the advantages of being a Jew is that to them belong the covenants, plural. It seems to me to indicate all the covenants belong to Israel. To what extent can we extrapolate that to Gentiles?
Well, the way Paul puts it is because we have been grafted in.
Well, okay, so that's the basis on which we say that some things apply to us. Does that mean that everything applies to us?
No.
And how do we draw the line of what does and what doesn't?
That's coming up. So if I can put that on hold, we'll come at a more opportune time to address that here in a second.
You're talking about soul rest? And you said that we go in...
Yeah, I don't want to call it that. But yeah, I was.
Okay.
Well, do you have a question about that? Oh, is that what I was talking about? Oh, well, see, I don't think the Bible teaches the immortality of the soul. So the reason I don't like the concept of soul rest is, why do we have to talk about the soul being asleep or at rest? Well, because it has to exist, right? Because Plato taught us that the soul is immortal. And the church picked up that doctrine and believes in the eternality and the immortality of the soul. That's not a biblical notion. Most of mankind is going to be destroyed. They are going to exist no longer. It's only God's people, God's elect, who are going to be given life and therefore an ongoing existence where their soul continues to exist. Well, how is my soul going to continue to exist? It's going to be recreated. See, the important thing to recognize is God, who can make everything out of absolutely nothing, as long as he has a concept of who Jack is, my being gone, my body being molecules being scattered to the wind, being eaten by a shark, none of that stuff matters. Because as long as God knows who Jack is, he can recreate me. And he can recreate me to be utterly and completely continuous with the Jack who was here living a life on the earth. And that seems to me to be the picture that we get in the Bible, is that he will, at the opportune time, he will recreate me, not exactly the way I was before, because I was mortal before. He's going to recreate me as an immortal version of me, of myself.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, what's your understanding of the way Jesus advocates or is going to advocate? Like, where he is right now, like this other place, is he watching me on the television and going, oh yeah, I'm going to want her? Or does he have no idea who I am right now, and at the end of this time, God is going to go, here she is, here's what she was about, and then he's going to go, okay.
I hadn't thought of that theory. There's this big reality TV show that he's watching.
Oh, I hope not.
And he's going to vote us on or off the island. Is where I don't know. I take it that these things are all metaphors. They're not literal realities. That is, he doesn't literally have to stand before God and say, God, all this happens in the twinkling of an eye, mm-hmm. right? So I don't see how it can be a literal reality. I don't expect that it is a literal reality. I don't have any problem with it being a literal reality, but I'm inclined to think that all these are just a metaphorical way of talking about what's going to happen to me and why it's going to happen to me. It has everything to do with Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's because of Jesus that I'm going to be given life. And it's just a metaphorical way of describing a role that makes him central to my receiving mercy. Mm-hmm. But what's literally going to happen, I don't know. That's a great question.
It doesn't matter either way.
As long as it works. Yeah. Okay, let's press on. Now we head into chapter 8, or paragraph part 14. As a synopsis, what he's going to do here is two things. He's going to now finally identify Jesus as the Messiah priest that Psalm 110 was talking about. Now, he did identify him in the last section in one sentence, briefly, kind of got ahead of himself. But for the most part, up till now, the hymn that he's been talking about is whoever this Messiah priest happens to be. But now, in chapter 8, it's going to be clear that he's talking about Jesus. However, he never explicitly mentions Jesus by name here. He mentioned him explicitly by name a few sentences ago, but he never explicitly mentions Jesus by name here. But everything about the paragraph makes it clear that it's Jesus that he has in mind. And then the second thing he's going to do, he's going to spell out the implications of him being the Messiah priest promised by Psalm 110. Okay, given that Jesus is that dude, what does that mean then for what's going to go down in Jesus' life and ministry? What is Jesus going to do? Namely, where he's headed is, he's going to get himself killed. He's going to die. He's going to be crucified. But that's coming later. But he needs to spell out the implications. So, since he's the Messiah priest promised by Psalm 110, he's going to have an offering to offer. You can't be a high priest and not offer an offering. So he has to have an offering to offer. That much, he says, is clear. And then secondly, the offering that he offers will be better, and his priestly service will be more distinguished than that of the Levitical priests. Why? Because Jesus has been assigned the task of being the real and true priest who offers the real and true offering. Jesus is the real and true priest of whom the Levitical priests are only a shadow, and they offer offerings that are only a shadow of the offering that Jesus is going to offer. So what's the import of that? Why is he making this point? Because Jesus' humiliation and crucifixion then do not make him less likely to actually be the Messiah, as his readers are thinking. Rather, they are perfectly in keeping with the claim that he is the Messiah. Because what has he been given to do? to be our high priest who brings the true and appropriate offering to God. And that Paul is clearly assuming, is implicitly communicating that his death is that offering. Okay, so let's look at the details. I don't think I read this yet. Okay, sorry. Chapter 8, 1 through 3. Now here is the main point in the things being said. We have such a high priest. He has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. He is an administrator of the holy rites, even with respect to the true tabernacle, which the Lord set up, not man. Every high priest is appointed to offer up gifts and offerings. Therefore, it is necessary for this one to have something to offer as well. Keep going. 4 through 6. Now, with regard to those who offer up gifts in accord with the covenant, who serve with a copy and shadow of the eternal realities, if he were on the earth, most assuredly he would not even be such a priest. It is just as Moses was directed when he was about to finish setting up the tabernacle. Now see, he says, that you make everything in accord with the blueprint which was shown to you on the mountain. But now he has obtained a more distinguished ritual service by as much as he is the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on the basis of better promises. Okay, he says, now here is the main point in the things being said. Okay, what's the main point? What he's just been talking about? No, what he's about to say. Namely, the main point is the next sentence. We have such a high priest. So in other words, he's saying, why have I been spending a chapter and a half spelling out the implications of Psalm 110 for the priestly role of the Messiah? Why have I been boring you with all of that? Well, here's the point. The high priest that is talked about, that is promised in Psalm 10, we have that high priest implicitly in the person of Jesus, in the individual of Jesus. He doesn't say that, but clearly that's what he's implying. We have such a high priest. He is seated at the right hand. I think that's his kind of oblique way of identifying Jesus as the one who is that high priest, because it's commonplace among the apostles and the New Testament writers to see Jesus' ascension into the clouds off of the Mount of Olives. He ascended into the heavens and disappeared. Where was he going? He was going to be at the right hand of the majesty on high. Remember Psalm 110 again. Psalm 110 says, the Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. And this, he's speaking to the Messiah there. Sit at my right hand until I make all your enemies a footstool for your feet. That's the part of the destiny, part of the role of the Messiah, is to be the victorious, conquering king over all of reality. And that's the place that God is going to give to him. Well, Jesus is the one who has ascended to the right hand. Now, as Psalm 110 says, things are not over yet. His enemies are not a footstool for his feet yet. But as the psalm said, sit at my right hand until I make all the enemies a footstool for your feet. In the interim, he has become fully qualified to be the embodiment of God's very reign over all of nature and over all of creation. Jesus is fully qualified for that as we speak right now. And that's what the apostles mean by he's seated at the right hand of the majesty on high. Jesus who walked on the water was not yet fully qualified. Jesus who turned the water into wine was not yet fully qualified. Jesus who called Lazarus out of the grave was not yet fully qualified. But Jesus now, who's seated at the right hand of the majesty on high, he is fully qualified. But in the purposes of God, in the time schedule of God, he's not yet going to grant him the victory that he will one day be granted. He's waiting patiently for the day when that will come. And that day will begin, at least, on the day of the wrath of the Lamb, when God says to the Son, okay, go and bring justice to the earth. And when he returns, he will come in wrath, and he will come to bring justice. So I think this is Paul's, although he doesn't name Jesus by name, he might as well have, because I think it's pretty clear that in the apostolic view, the one seated at the right hand is Jesus. Now, that doesn't mean that any of the New Testament writers take that language literally. I don't think they do. I don't think Jesus' ascension into the sky settles the question of where Jesus is right now. I think as they're looking for the ninth planet, they're not going to see God's throne somewhere out there and look a little bit to the right and see Jesus sitting there to the right. It ain't going to happen. That's not what they're talking about. This is, again, a metaphor that describes the nature of Jesus' authority. It's not talking about his location right now. What happened to Jesus? I think he just popped out of existence when he went into the sky. Why did God have him rise into the sky? Could have had him just pop out of existence right there standing on the Mount of Olives. But he had him rise into the sky in order to create this kind of living metaphor of who Jesus was. He was this one who was going to be taken up to be seated at the right hand of the Father in the heavens. But we all know that the Father isn't in the heavens in that sense. He's not literally in the sky. He transcends all of created reality. So you can't take Jesus up into the sky and be at the right hand of where God actually is. Now, let me be clear, he did literally ascend into the sky. I have no doubt about that. I'm not denying that. But we don't know what happened after that. We don't know that he stayed up there somewhere. We don't know where he is. I don't know where he is. Okay, then he goes on. He has taken a seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. He is an administrator of the holy rites or the sacred tasks, if you will. He's a minister of the sacred tasks of the true tabernacle itself. Again, I don't think he means that there is the true tabernacle. I'm not sure how the other English translations might have that. They might say the true tabernacle in the heavenlies, I believe some of them have. I describe that as the eternal, where am I? Oh, no. No, I'm sorry, not here. So just even with respect to the true tabernacle, I don't think that God has another tabernacle somewhere, a literal physical structure where he is worshiped in truth by the real and true high priest. All of this, again, is just a metaphor. Well, what is it a metaphor for? Well, what was the tabernacle on earth? The tabernacle on earth was the place where you went if you wanted to go into the presence of God and engage in some kind of transaction with God. What we've been mostly talking about are propitiatory offerings. But it could be a place that you prayed. It could be a place that you gave praise, gave gratitude, thanksgiving to God. But you conduct that in the tabernacle because you're going into the very presence of God to communicate something to God about your desires and your attitudes. Well, what would the true tabernacle be? The true tabernacle would be the place that you need to go if you want to really transact business with God. The earthly temple, as he puts it, was made with human hands. But where's the tabernacle that God himself built, that he set up, not Moses? God would deign to descend on the tabernacle in the form of a theophany and make it as if he were there, make it as if he were present there at times. But we all know that that was just a grand, again, a living metaphor. The reality is the whole creation is his temple. He transcends creation. He lives in a transcendent realm that is totally above and beyond and other than this place where we live. So to talk about a true tabernacle is simply to talk about Jesus carrying on transactions in relationship to God where the transaction actually counts. It's the real deal. It's not a shadow. It's not an image. It's not a reflection. It's the real thing itself. Well, in order for that transaction to take place, you don't actually need a tabernacle for that to take place. All you need is the knowledge of God, of his Son, and his Son willing that I be a part of his kingdom. That's all you really literally need. And I think all this is a way of describing that literal reality. But that was foreshadowed by the Levitical priests in the temple lighting incense here, singing a psalm here, offering an offering here. There were all kinds of tasks that were a part of the sacred functioning of the temple. And it was all a way of doing business with God in the way he had told them that he wanted them to do business with God. But there was nothing about that that was ultimate. There was nothing about that that was real. It was all just imagery and images of that which actually counted. And what actually counts is that God grant me the mercy to be a part of his people for all of eternity. And what I need is for another individual other than me to function in a priest-like capacity, not really a priest, but a priest-like capacity by being a go-between between me and God and to be my advocate who intercedes for me, appeals to God to be merciful to me so that God might grant me that mercy. Well, that act of appealing to God for mercy, the counterpart of that is all the mumbo-jumbo that the Levitical priest did in the earthly tabernacle. So Paul's way of describing it is that Jesus is in the true tabernacle. He's an administrator, a minister of the sacred tasks in the true tabernacle, which the Lord set up, not man. And then he makes a brief little argument here to finish off this paragraph. Every high priest is appointed to offer up gifts and offerings. I mean, that's just what high priests do. That's what they're assigned to do, is to offer up gifts and offerings. Therefore, it is necessary for this one, Jesus, to have something to offer as well. Now, in several paragraphs, he's going to tell us what it is that he offers. He offers up his own body. But now, remember, these are baby steps here. Now he's just making the point that he can't be functioning as our high priest if he doesn't offer something. So he's going to have some offering that he's going to offer. Questions on that paragraph before I go on to the next?
I actually have a lot of questions, but I think I'll limit it to two. First one, I guess, is in your description of, and I guess I'm asking if this is accurate, what you're saying. In your description in the last couple of paragraphs, it sounds like what you're saying is Jesus' role doesn't really take effect or begin until the end of this age and then on into the next as king. So in Sunday school theology, Jesus has to be there right now as we go through life because we need to pray to him, and that's how we get through to God, or he's there to hold our hand through the tough times. So what you're saying makes it sound like really he's doesn't really even need to be there yet. Is that accurate? And can you speak
that is
to
accurate,
that?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think we have been taught that we need an intercessor right now. If I want a little red sports car, I can't ask God for a little red sports car on my own. I need to ask Jesus to ask God. So I need him to intercede for me. If I want to be healed of some ailment, I need Jesus to intercede for me. Whatever it is that I might need in life, whatever it is I might want in life, I have an intercessor now who can take those requests to God. I mean, this is commonplace in Roman Catholic theology, where you not only have Jesus being an intercessor, but the Virgin Mary and all of the saints and everybody. I mean, how do we get through life? You just ask all those people to go to bat for you and pull the levers and the strings to get God to act for you, to make life go better for you. There is nothing, absolutely nothing in Hebrews that in any way remotely suggests that that's what he's talking about. The intercession, every time he brings up intercession or anything like that, the issue is always my destiny. Am I going to get life or am I going to get death? I need him to intercede if I'm going to receive life rather than death and condemnation. So you're absolutely right. Now, having said that, well, I don't need an intercessor to ask to be healed, to ask to be kept safe, to ask to be comforted. I can go to God directly. God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being. He's as close as could possibly be to me. I don't need an intercessor to relay messages to him. I can deal directly with him. So it's not like we're forlorn and alone in the world. God is fully capable of managing and governing absolutely every detail of my life, and he's a wise and good God who wouldn't let a sparrow fall to the ground unless it fit his purposes. So God is not going to allow anything whatsoever to happen in my life. No suffering, no adverse circumstances are going to come my way, and except those that are absolutely essential to accomplishing his good purposes in my life. And we can take that to the bank. We can count on that. And that's what Jesus taught us about our relationship with the Father. But notice, he wasn't making himself an intercessor there. He was teaching people to trust the Father. You had a second question?
Yeah, I'm trying to think how to phrase it. But I don't know if this is, I think I have two questions that are kind of wrapped up together. But so the picture that seems to be emerging is that Jesus was sinless, but it would not have been enough for him to have just died of old age in his bed to qualify him to be our intercessor,
right?
Because there had to be a sacrifice made, but he had to be the sacrifice. Is that what you're accurate?
That is true. I think I don't know that we could know that from Psalm 110, and I don't know that we could even know that from all of that that you said, from what Paul is arguing here. As it happens, he got crucified rather than dying. But that would have to do with just how God had purposed to do things. And God could have purposed things differently than he did. But as a matter of fact, his purpose was to qualify him through the obedience of the suffering of the cross. As a matter of fact, if God had chosen some other way, that's his business. But he didn't choose some other way. He chose to do it this way. Now, I think we can explore, well, why did he choose to do it that way? And I think I have commented on this in the past. Jesus' act was an absolutely heroic act of being willing to submit to torture for you and me. Talk about love for you and me. Talk about obedience to the Father, an obedience that was sorely tested in the Garden of Gethsemane. Tested. He came out with flying colors, but you know that he was torn, in the sense that he didn't really relish the idea of being tortured. That was not something he considered to be a lot of fun, good idea. And he was in anguish over what was going to be required of him. But as anguish-filled as he was, he could nonetheless say, but it's not about what I want, it's about what you want. Let's do your will. That's a heroic act of obedience, as well as a heroic act of love. So no wonder that we have a better hope under the new covenant than we did under the Levitical priesthood. Do you want Isaiah ben Isaiah being your advocate, or do you want Jesus being your advocate? Jesus, who was clearly the beloved Son in whom God was well pleased, because look at the love that he emulated, look at the obedience that he demonstrated. All the ways that he showed himself to be an amazing human being, devoted to God, void of evil, separated from sinners, unlike us, who was utterly and completely, perfectly pleasing to God. He's somebody who can advocate for me. And so it's on the basis of his priestly intercession that I have much more certainty and confidence and hope that when the time comes, God will grant me mercy, because Jesus, that dude, has my back. So I think if he had died in his old age, it wouldn't have been the same act of love. It wouldn't have been the same act of obedience. You see what I'm saying? There wouldn't have been this dramatic way in which he had made himself teleos, made himself fully qualified to function as our high priest and intercessor.
This may be ridiculous, so feel free to ignore it. In Stephen's vision before he is stoned, twice it mentions that he saw Jesus standing at the right hand of God, and here he's pictured as sitting. Now, I think that means something to the Jews.
You think what?
I think that means something to the Jews.
Huh.
But why is Jesus seen as standing in one instance but sitting in the other?
I actually don't know, but what goes through my head is they're about to stone Stephen, and he stood up going, what? But I don't know. Yeah. Okay, next week we'll start with paragraph 39 and press on into chapter 8.